Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 11th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, the indirect effects of aerosols on the carbon cycle, pristine gas clouds 2 billion years after the Big Bang, and belt tightening at U.S. science funding agencies, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. Anthropogenic aerosols do a number on the climate. Through interactions with the atmosphere and clouds, they influence the amount of solar radiation absorbed and reflected by the Earth. This week, Natalie Mahowald of Cornell University proposes an additional aerosol effect on biogeochemical cycles, that is, the cycles that govern how an element like carbon interacts with the land, oceans, and atmosphere. Mahowald reports that the net indirect biogeochemical effect of aerosols is to cool the climate while simultaneously increasing the amount of carbon dioxide that the atmosphere and troposphere can absorb. The findings could impact how we approach the anthropogenic contributors to climate change. Mahowald spoke with me about her work.
There's an effect of aerosols on the climate system that's been previously ignored, and this is because aerosols don't just act when they're in the atmosphere. They also, when they're deposited onto the land or the ocean ecosystems, they can actually fertilize those ecosystems and cause additional carbon dioxide to be taken up. In addition, the climate impact of the aerosols in the atmosphere actually can change the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Okay, and can you just define briefly what aerosols are exactly and where they originate?
Aerosols are tiny particles in the atmosphere, and they can either be liquid or solid phase, and they have many different chemical compositions, and they have many different sources. So it's kind of a really broad term to describe anything floating in the atmosphere that's a solid or a liquid. Some common examples would be from your tailpipe, there's soot that comes out, black carbon. There's also aerosols made in the atmosphere, like sulfur dioxide from coal-fired power plants, converts to sulfate in the atmosphere, and that's an aerosol as well.
And I remember back in the 90s, aerosols were kind of a hot topic. You know, we'd especially hear about pressurized containers like hairspray and spray paint and things like that. So what do we already know about the effects of aerosols, both direct and indirect?
So it's a little bit interesting, but those aerosol cans you're talking about, that's not the same kind of aerosol we're talking about here. So they're kind of emitted a totally different way.
Oh.
So the kind of aerosols that we're concerned about here are really emitted from coal-fired power plants or indirectly from human actions on land use. But those cans, even if we were still using them, we wouldn't worry about those. Those were emitting chlorofluorocarbons, so we banned those for that reason. Mm. So aerosols are very heterogeneous in nature, so there's many different kinds of aerosols. But what it looks like they do from a climate perspective is they generally tend to cool, although some aerosols tend to warm the climate, but most of them tend to cool. In terms of how humans are changing the aerosols, I should say, the humans are emitting a lot of extra aerosols through fossil fuel combustion or land use, and those aerosols are tending to cool the planet. At the same time, these aerosols are also interacting with clouds, and clouds are a major player in climate, and anytime you change clouds at all, you can really impact climate. And we also think that aerosol-cloud interactions and anthropogenic aerosol-cloud interactions are tending to cool the climate. So already aerosols are a big player in climate, and they tend to be cooling the climate, whereas our greenhouse gas emissions are tending to warm the climate. So aerosols are already kind of looks like hiding the impact of carbon dioxide increases on the climate.
Okay, and so that's what's already sort of understood about aerosols. And then here in this paper, you're arguing specifically for more indirect biogeochemical effects of aerosols. So what exactly do those entail?
So we're arguing here for an indirect effect of aerosols on biogeochemistry. And biogeochemistry is kind of this funny new word that includes biology and chemical cycling and geology. And really what we're talking about to a large extent is the carbon cycle, and that means the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So aerosols can be deposited onto the land or the ocean and carry nutrients with them, for example, nitrogen or phosphorus or iron. And that fertilizes the land or the ocean and makes it so the ocean or the biota can be more active and draw down more carbon dioxide. In addition, the aerosols, because of the direct and indirect effects we just talked about, can change the climate, and that in and of itself appears to be enhancing how much carbon dioxide the land and the ocean can take up as well. So there's this indirect effect of aerosols on the biogeochemical cycles, and over the last 130 years, it could be that these aerosols have had the impact of allowing the land and the ocean to take up an extra 7 to 50 parts per million. We don't really know how much of CO2, and 7 to 50 parts per million of CO2 is a lot of CO2 if we think about the fact that CO2 has risen about 100 parts per million over the last 150 years or so. It could be only a 7% of the signal, or it could be 50% of the signal has changed because of this aerosol indirect effect on biogeochemistry.
So how are aerosol emissions sort of affected by the current policies on carbon emissions and pollution and things like that?
Well, aerosols are a big public health hazard. In the United States and Europe, we're already cutting aerosol emissions, which is a good thing from a public health perspective. We need to have cleaner air, and a large part of that is the aerosols. And the developing countries, as they get wealthy, are also going to hopefully start cutting their aerosol emissions because it's such a public health hazard if they don't. So from that perspective, we expect aerosols to start going down very soon into the future. In addition, as we try to move off carbon-based fossil fuels and other energy sources, we'll probably get rid of a lot of combustion sources of energy, and that also will decrease the amount of aerosols that are emitted, because a lot of the aerosols we have in the atmosphere are because of combustion and fossil fuel sources also. So they're emitted at the same time as carbon dioxide is. So when we have, or if we have stronger climate policies, this will result in a reduction in the aerosols. And that and the public health concern may actually make our climate problem even harder to solve, because there'll be less of this aerosol enhancement of the carbon dioxide uptake by the land and the oceans.
And so what's the residence time of these aerosols in the atmosphere? I mean, if we completely cut off emissions, how much longer will what's currently in the atmosphere sort of stay there and percolate?
That's a good question. We're talking here about tropospheric aerosols, so aerosols close to the surface. So they stay in the atmosphere maybe between a day and maybe 3 weeks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So not very long. But the indirect effect on the biogeochemistry is a much longer time scale. And so, you know, even if we cut emissions completely of aerosols tomorrow, we may not see a response for, decades or something on that time frame. So the aerosol indirect effect on biogeochemistry is a long time scale process. And so as we cut the aerosol emissions, we would expect to see on longer time scales a response.
Well, Natalie Mahowald, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Natalie Mahowald writes about the biogeochemical effects of anthropogenic aerosols in this week's Science.
Stars are the element factories of the universe. Before they formed, the only elements present in the universe were the first three entries on the periodic table: hydrogen, helium, and lithium. All the other heavier elements, which astronomers refer to as metals, were produced later in stars. This week, a team of astronomers reports the detection of faraway gas clouds with no trace of these heavier elements. These so-called pristine clouds date to about 2 billion years after the Big Bang, a time by which stars and galaxies had already started forming, and most of the universe's gas is expected to have been enriched in metals. The finding could change some fundamental assumptions about the transport and distribution of heavy elements in the early universe, as lead author Michele Fumagalli explained.
Galaxies are very fascinating ecosystems in which the exchange of gas with the outer universe plays a crucial role. So our current effort is to use spectroscopy to map the gas distribution around these distant galaxies. And as part of this study, we discovered two gas clouds of pristine gas in the distant universe, 2 billion years after the Big Bang, when the age of the universe was about a fifth of its current age. These clouds are composed mainly of hydrogen and its isotope, deuterium, and we don't see other elements like carbon, oxygen, or iron. And this is what is telling us that this gas is of primordial composition, and it was produced during the first few minutes after the Big Bang.
Okay, well, in measuring the relative sort of pristineness of a gas cloud like this, you look at a quantity, I believe, called metallicity. And I think to astronomers, the word metal means something maybe a bit different from what it means to the rest of us. Can you briefly tell us what this term metallicity actually refers to?
Sure. So during the first few minutes after the Big Bang, only the lightest elements of the periodic tables are produced. So this is mostly hydrogen, deuterium, helium, and a bit of lithium. All the other elements that are common in the sun or on the Earth, such as carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, silicon, even iron, are produced later on in stars. And so these stellar products are what we commonly refer to as metals.
Okay, and so the idea is that these clouds are pristine because they don't contain these other elements that are usually produced in stars. And you were looking at a very distant patch of sky, I guess, an extremely distant place. One thing that always kind of blows my mind is that when we're looking at something like that, you're also looking back in time. In this case, as you mentioned, you know, about 2 billion years after the Big Bang. What do we know, both, you know, in terms of these elemental abundances, what do we know from other observations about that at this time after the Big Bang?
Yeah, so we can look back in time. This is because it takes some time for the light to travel across the universe. And so when we use powerful telescope, the Keck telescope in Hawaii in our case, we look at distant objects and we see them as they were far back in time. And previous observations of gas in distant galaxies and also in the more diffuse gas that is in the universe have always revealed some level of enrichment. So the spread in the observed metallicity is quite big. It's more than orders of magnitude. And very dense regions tend to be quite metal-rich to the levels that are comparable to what we see in the sun. In fact, these are the sites where the stars form and so where the metals are produced. But we also see metals in the more diffuse region, although 2 or 3 order magnitude less than what we see in the sun. And we see metal because even though metal are produced inside galaxies, they can be ejected far from their site of production, so they can pollute the surrounding universe. So we see metals pretty much everywhere we look.
Okay, so at this particular time, 2 billion years after the Big Bang, these two gas clouds that you've studied are a big contrast. They seem to be pretty much pristine. How did you come to find or study those particular clouds and to establish that compositional anomaly?
Yeah, so our ongoing effort is to study in a statistical way what are the properties of gas in galaxies in the distant universe. And since we cannot see this gas directly, we use a technique to infer their properties. And so what we do is to use a spectrograph on big telescope, and we spread the light of bright distant sources, for example, quasars, and we obtain a spectrum of different frequencies or colors. And if there is gas in between us and the quasars, we can see this gas in absorption within the spectrum. And since every element has a unique fingerprint that shows up as a dark line in our spectrum, we can precisely measure the composition of the gas by looking at this sequence of pattern of lines.
And so you essentially came across these two gas clouds in the course of the other work you were doing.
Yes, so we were doing a search for the gas property in galaxies. And by looking at this spectra, we found these gas clouds. And what we see is that there are a series of lines that are telling us that there is quite a bit of hydrogen in these clouds. And we also see absorption associated to deuterium. Deuterium is one of the isotopes of hydrogen and is produced in the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. But we know that this element is quite fragile. So the presence of deuterium alone is indicative that these clouds are not very evolved systems. Mm-hmm. But the real unique feature is that when we look at these two gas clouds and we look in the spectrum for lines associated to metals, so to carbon, oxygen, and so on, we don't see them. And we know exactly where to look. And so the lack of these lines is what is telling us that these clouds are primordial.
So at a time when the rest of, you know, when elsewhere we were seeing star formation and creation of these elements, we're not seeing it in these areas. So that's a pretty remarkable observation relative, I guess, to what had been seen before. How would you sort of sum up the significance of this find? What do you think are the main implications?
Yeah, so there are a few implications. The first one is cosmological. We see pristine gas, and the existence of this pristine gas has been predicted by theory, by the Big Bang theory. However, this is the first time we actually see this gas, and so this agreement between theory and observation combined to other independent verification of this model is indicative that we have a quite good understanding of the origins of the universe. There is also a second interesting aspect of this detection, and this is about the metal content of the universe. So as we were saying prior to this discovery, the lowest measurement of the metal abundance in the universe were about 1 over 1,000, the metallicity of what's in the sun. And so based on this empirical evidence, people started to believe in a floor to the metallicity of the cosmic structure. So essentially, that nothing could be less than 1,000 the solar metallicity. And this idea is actually in line with theory, because we expected that early on in the history of the universe, metals were produced and dispersed from galaxies, polluting the pristine gas generated after the Big Bang about this floor. So our discovery is providing a new information on how metals that are so necessary for life are released from galaxies in the early universe. And there is also a third exciting aspect of this discovery, and is that theory predicts that galaxies grow in the universe thanks to streams of cold gas. They are called the cold flows or cold streams. However, these cold flows have never been observed. And so we don't know this for sure yet, but the pristine gas clouds we have found are potential candidates for these very elusive cold flows. So this is something we should explore more.
So kind of a lot of tantalizing hints here. What are the next steps in exploring this further?
Yeah, so the obvious next step is to understand how common these clouds are. We need to study a large sample of spectra and try to quantify how frequent these primordial clouds are. If it turns out that this pristine gas is not so hard to find, then, well, we need to revise our current theory of how metals are ejected from the site of production into the universe. So we might be entering an exciting time for both theorists and observers. Another interesting study is now to explicitly search for galaxies that lie in proximity of these gas clouds. So our spectra cannot tell us this information right now, so we need new data. But the discovery of galaxies nearby this gas would be very exciting for the theory of cold flows, and it would provide additional evidence that this gas is, in fact, associated with these elusive streams of gas.
Michele Fumagalli, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
You can read the paper by Michele Fumagalli and colleagues at www.scienceexpress.org.
In last week's issue of Science, a paper from the lab of David Sabatini explored how cells sense that they're running low on amino acids and found this amino acid sensing mechanism in the activity of a specific protein complex within the lysosome. That's the organelle in the cell chiefly responsible for the breakdown of cellular waste products and debris, a process known as autophagy. In this week's Science Signaling podcast, host Annalisa Van Hook talked about the paper with Sabatini, who explained why the team was drawn to the lysosome as a possible location for this kind of signaling.
The question as to why this seems to be happening on a lysosomal surface, at least our evidence suggests that's the case, is an interesting one, and we don't fully understand the why aspect of this. Our current hypothesis is that the amino acid content of lysosomes is somehow important to the cell in telling it whether to grow or not. You might imagine that perhaps lysosomes are storing amino acids, or that for some reason that amino acids being inside the lysosomes are important to the cell to making the decision to grow. And so to some extent, the idea that lysosomes have a key role in amino acid metabolism is really, you know, it's a new one, but in retrospect, maybe is not so shocking, because lysosomes are where autophagosomes fuse and autophagy takes place and the amino acids are liberated. So if you had to put a major growth sensor that cares about amino acids, maybe on the surface of the lysosome is not such a bad place to do it.
You can find David Sabatini's complete interview on the Science Signaling website. Just go to stke.sciencemag.org/resources and click on podcasts.
A package of News Focus articles this week addresses a conundrum confronting U.S. research funding agencies, the need to do more with less as Congress moves forward with cuts to discretionary funding. Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis sat down with me to talk about the decisions that major research agencies could be facing.
The effort to reduce the federal deficit and cut spending has generated two important questions for the scientific community. The first is, will Congress and the White House protect research? Will they fence off funding for the science agencies and accept the argument that research fuels economic growth and therefore needs to be protected? And the second question is, if they don't, how will agencies respond to an extended period of flat or shrinking budgets? That would be unprecedented. So those are the questions that the scientific community is going to have to grapple with.
Well, let's look at the first question first. You know, we've heard over the years a lot of rhetoric about the need to invest in research for global competitiveness, to better educate the next generation of scientists, et cetera. Take us back historically a bit. How has science usually fared in these budget wars?
Well, this will come as a surprise to a lot of scientists, but science has fared pretty well over the years, certainly since the post-war period. There have been periods of less growth, of course, and everyone remembers a golden age, but at the time it never seemed quite as golden. But historically, the research budget has grown through Democrat and Republican presidents, through Democrat and Republican Congresses, even though there isn't a science budget.
But I guess now we're starting to see the narrative shift a bit. Now it's all about science going on a diet, doing more with less. The idea, I guess, that science needs to tighten its belt, too, in these times.
Well, I think that's the big question, because science and research never gets into the A group of issues that are discussed. You don't hear the candidates debating it. You don't hear Congress debating it as a whole. It always comes out in the wash as a result of cuts or growth in what's called discretionary spending, mm-hmm. which is where all the science funding comes from. But certainly all the signs seem to indicate that there just isn't going to be room. In fact, just recently, one of the appropriation bills for 2012 that was brought to the floor of the Senate by Senator Barbara Mikulski, a very staunch supporter of research, and Mikulski had to admit on the floor that even I, supporter of science, had to cut programs from the National Science Foundation, from NASA, and I didn't like to do it one bit, but I didn't have a choice.
And these are all kind of tied in a way to this debt reduction brouhaha over the summer, that's right?
Right. So what you're referring to there was an agreement that was reached to avoid a government shutdown at the beginning of August. And what it said, it's called by the name Budget Control Reduction Act, but what it said basically was, we are going to create a committee which is going to come up with a plan to reduce the deficit by at least $1.2 trillion. And if we don't, automatic cuts of that amount are going to come down a year from now, equally between the defense and the civilian side. The advantage of that is no one had to make a decision. But in retrospect, there's definitely buyer's remorse. Both the White House and especially Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, are not happy with one or more aspects of that, and they're hoping to do something about it. But the law is very specific. It says this committee will come up with a recommendation by the end of this month, and then Congress will vote on it before Christmas.
Well, before we kind of start looking at how this is playing out in some specific agencies, before this debt reduction issue and the stuff of the past summer, there was this stimulus package. How did science actually do in that stimulus package?
Well, science did very well. There was, depending on how you count it, roughly $20 billion in basic research. Billions more if you include technology programs, loan guarantees, and so on. And that helped NIH, that helped the National Science Foundation, it helped the Office of Science, Department of Energy. Those three agencies together were able to do a lot of things that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to do. fund more researchers, build new facilities, upgrade facilities, support new initiatives, all kinds of things.
But of course, the stimulus money eventually runs out.
And it has. It was two-year money in Washington parlance, and that 2 years ended this fall. So now agencies are back to their annual appropriation. And that's what we were referring to earlier when Senator Mikulski got up and said, I had to cut funding for those specific agencies because my allocation, in other words, the piece of the pie that I was given to distribute, is smaller than it was last year.
Well, let's look at some specific agencies now, some of the trade-offs that the big science agencies are making, starting with NIH, I guess in some ways a victim of some of its recent success.
Well, NIH has had a lot of success and a lot of support. You know, curing and treating disease is something that every legislator and every member of the public can identify with. So it's easy to understand why understanding how cancer, you know, develops is necessary in order to cure cancer. So what NIH has done is it's built on that support and expanded in all areas. And very specifically, it's tried to maintain enough new investigators going into the system every year. In other words, people who don't previously have grants.
Right.
Obviously, you can only do that if your budget's increasing. If it's not, then you have to get into this trade-off between how many grants versus how big the grant should be versus how long they should last. And if you cut any one of those things, there's going to be repercussions.
So what is NIH looking at to kind of make those trade-offs?
Well, they've asked the community to suggest ways that you can tinker with that system, again, in the hope that the upside will be, you know, more positive than the downside. But there aren't a lot of attractive choices.
Mm. And NASA is looking at some pretty unattractive choices of its own in some rather tangible projects.
NASA has a harder problem to solve because it is based on big missions that cost billions of dollars. You can't trim a mission. You can't send up half of the Hubble Space Telescope. You either do or you don't. And so there's missions down the road, including a mission to Mars to collect samples and return them, that either will happen or won't happen. There's no middle ground.
And there's a lot of, you know, reading the article, there's a lot of infighting between the different groups that are tied to these various missions.
Well, certainly, because there's a lot of support for these so-called flagship missions, because there's a lot of instruments and a lot of investigators and a lot of graduate students who get supported by those. But those cost billions of dollars. And so the argument is, can we maintain the health of the community with more smaller missions versus fewer bigger missions? When your budget's increasing, you can do some of both.
Well, speaking of smaller science, I mean, for a lot of basic research that isn't covered by something like NASA or the NIH, the National Science Foundation seems to be kind of the court of first resort. How do things look for that budget?
Well, NSF has a different problem, which is it funds research across the board, from astronomy to zoology and everything in between. So it can't just cut back in one area. It has to look at hard sciences, the natural sciences, the social and behavioral sciences. And when there isn't enough money to go around, the big decision is, do you spread the pain or do you decide that certain disciplines are so important that you protect those and then you cut more dramatically from other disciplines? And, of course, there's obviously consequences to that.
Not an easy choice, I would think. And I guess NSF has a pretty substantial educational component, too.
Yeah, that's one of its missions, not just to support undergraduate and graduate training, but also pre-college, elementary and secondary schools. And so there's always a tension between the education and the research directorates. And in tight budget times, that tension becomes even greater.
So for these agencies and for the other ones that you're reporting on in this package, though, it seems like a lot is going to hinge on just what happens in the next couple of weeks. You alluded to this super committee. Any thoughts on what's going to happen there? Or?
Well, I think that that's important, but it's not going to be the final answer by any means. I think what the scientists need to look at is, what are people saying about how they're going to get to these cuts? And whether innovation and research even comes up. If it doesn't, then they're just going to have to bide their time and see what it looks like once they get more specific. It's hard on a very general level to know what cuts will mean for the scientific community.
Jeffrey Mervis, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Stuart.
Jeffrey Mervis and other science correspondents write about budget cuts to scientific research in a package of News Focus articles in this week's issue.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So first, David, we're taking steps toward treating the obesity epidemic.
Right, Carrie. And this isn't just about treating obesity. It's about actually finding a brand new way to think about drug discovery. What researchers usually do when they're trying to discover new drugs is they take a whole bunch of compounds and they throw them on cells. I'm being a little bit melodramatic here, but they do these very long, complicated screening processes where they hope that one of these compounds has the desired effect on the cells or the animals that they're hoping for. It's a very sort of non-specific way to go about things. But in this new study, it involves a team of researchers. It's actually a married couple from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. What they do is they work with something called peptides. And these are basically bits of proteins. And they take these bits of proteins and they, for all intents and purposes, stick them on the shell of a bacterial virus. And they inject this combination into brain-dead patients. And these are patients that basically have said that they are okay with their having their bodies used for science. And what the researchers then do is they try to see where these various peptide slash bacterial combinations go to. They all go to different parts of the body depending on what peptides are on the top of the virus. So some will target the pancreas and some will target the liver and some will target cancer cells and some won't target cancer cells. And their original idea was to see, well, what peptides target cancer cells, because if we can figure out which peptides those are, then we can attach maybe a toxin to them and then we could give that combination to people. And these peptides, rather than going everywhere in the body where the toxin would go everywhere in the body and hurt you, it would just hurt your cancer cells and it would be a way potentially to cure cancer. But that's not what they did in this study. This study, they were interested in obesity and they figured, hey, you know, if we can target cancer cells, can we target fat cells as well? Can we find peptides that are specific for fat and use that as a way basically for destroying fat?
So exactly how do they target these fat cells?
Well, basically what they did was they repeated this experiment. They looked for peptides in these brain dead patients that would not target fat cells specifically, but that targeted the blood vessels that fed these cells. And there had been some anecdotal evidence that potentially by clamping off the blood supply to fat cells, you would cause that fat to die and you would cause an animal to lose weight. And that's exactly what the researchers found. Basically, they isolated a peptide combination that did target the blood vessels that feed fat. And then they attached a toxin to this combination. Then they injected this into monkeys, and specifically overweight monkeys. And what they found was that the monkeys that were treated with this new drug combination lost between 7% and 15% of their body weight after about 4 weeks. And not only that, their waist circumference dropped by up to 14%.
Okay, so you spoke about these patients at this cancer center.
Right.
What's the connection between them and these monkeys?
Well, basically the patients aren't actually being treated. These brain-dead people are basically just a way to figure out which peptides are going to be specific for the fat. And once the researchers figured that out, then they take these peptides, put something toxic on them, and then they inject that into an animal that they want to lose weight. They're not trying to get these brain-dead people to lose weight, but basically what they're trying to see is, can we use these people to develop a drug that then can be used in humans also down the line? But before they do that, they want to make sure that it works in an animal model. And in this case, they're using fat monkeys.
So then what are the next steps here?
Well, the next steps are, it sounds very promising, but there's potentially a lot of side effects here. You got to imagine if you're choking off blood vessels.
Sounds awfully controversial.
Right. Could be very dangerous, especially if these peptides end up not being as specific as the researchers think they are. If they really are targeting other blood vessels in the body, you could have things like organ failure and a whole host of other problems. So they really have to make sure that this is a very specific therapy. And once they do that and they prove it's safe, this could be a brand new way to fight obesity, not only in monkeys, but in the rest of us.
And in our next story, we have a little bit of insight into how humans became the social creatures that we are today.
Right. Well, Carrie, all you need to do is look around you to see how social our society is. We live in these big groups. A lot of us live in cities. We have governments and a global economy. And every day we're interacting with lots and lots of people. And the question is, how did we get so social in the first place? Why are we not just sort of all doing our own thing, or maybe just in very small groups? And researchers have been interested in this question for a long time, and they sort of figured that it was a very gradual process. They figured that maybe, you know, you know, way back in evolution, a couple primates paired up, and then maybe, you know, a few million years later, they paired up with a few more individuals, and then it eventually just became the norm for us to have these sort of big, complicated societies. And that's actually what they see in the birds and the bees. It turns out that these animals, if you sort of go back in evolutionary history, it appears that single individuals paired off and began living with a few offspring, and then these groups grew gradually larger and larger and larger. So researchers just assume the same thing happened with us and all of our primate relatives. But that's actually not what they found in this new study.
Well, so what was new about this study?
Well, what they did was they looked at 217 primate species. And one of their growing hypotheses was that, you know, maybe the environment actually influences how social we are. In other words, if, say, food resources are really scarce, maybe that would cause us to band together in large groups because that would help us hunt and forage better. And maybe this isn't evolution really at all. It's just sort of we're responding to our environment. But when the researchers looked at a bunch of primates, they found that the environment really didn't seem to play a role, that regardless of where primates live or how plentiful or scarce food resources were, they didn't really affect the size of the group that they were in. So it must be something evolutionary going on there. And so what the researchers then did was they created this statistical model where they could go back virtually millions of years and try to find what is the way that makes the most sense. What was the simplest way for evolution to sort of get from just one or two individuals hanging out to a whole group of individuals hanging out? And what they found is it doesn't seem to have been a gradual process at all. It seems to sort of been this explosion where you just went from solitary individuals to these larger, complicated groups. And they think it happened, according to their calculations, around 52 million years ago.
What would have been the impetus for this?
Well, so the thing that may have been happening around this time is that the ancestors of today's primates may have become more active during the day. The idea is that they used to hunt at night, and if you're hunting at night, it kind of makes sense to be more solitary. You know, if you're traveling in a big group, you're going to make a lot of noise, and if you're hunting at night, you have some other advantages where it'd be better to be by yourself. But when they start hunting during the day, all of a sudden you're exposed to predators. You know, they can see you much easier, and if you're by yourself, you know, there really is safety in numbers. And so the scientists think that perhaps around this time, just because of a change in hunting strategy, that it made sense for groups to get bigger and that this sort of caught on and this is sort of how things progress through evolutionary time.
And our last story is looking at the elusive spotted horse.
Well, this is the question about whether the spotted horse is an imaginary creature. And anybody who's seen white horses with black spots around today know that it's not an imaginary creature. But was it a real creature 25,000 years ago? And the reason researchers are asking themselves this question is because, as you may know, Carrie, there's a bunch of caves in Europe, particularly in southern France and northern Spain, that are filled with these paintings of rhinoceroses, wild cattle, and a bunch of horses. And a lot of these paintings are tens of thousands of years old. And a lot of the horses in these paintings are horses that would be familiar to us today, brown horses and black horses. But among these horses is this white horse with black spots. And the reason researchers wondered if it was just an imaginary horse at the time is because they thought that this particular type of horse was a product of horse domestication. And horse domestication only begins about 5,000 years ago, which is way too recent for these horses to have appeared in these ancient cave paintings. And so what they sort of speculated up until now is, well, you know, these cave painters drew some pretty realistic creatures. They were drawing these brown and these black horses and these rhinos. But occasionally they were doing things that were more sort of spiritual or metaphorical, and therefore they were drawing these more imaginary or fanciful creatures like a white horse with black spots.
So this study was trying to get to the bottom of whether or not this was symbolic or realistic, these illustrations. So
exactly.
So how did they tackle that question?
Well, it's tough, you would think, because you can't travel back in time and see if these horses were really there. So the researchers did the next closest thing, was they basically analyzed DNA from a bunch of prehistoric horse bones that had been found in Siberia and Western Europe that dated from about 20,000 years ago. And when they did the DNA analysis, the DNA actually gives clues to what these horses look like. And as they expected, they saw DNA that would correlate with a brown horse or a black horse. But they also saw DNA that corresponded to a leopard-like spotting in horses, much like today's white horses with black spots. And that said to them, aha, I guess these horses did exist tens of thousands of years ago, and they were roaming the landscape. And so what that means is that when these early humans were painting horses, they were really painting what they saw. They weren't really inventing creatures. They were just representing what they were seeing in their environment.
So why was there this period of time in which this spotted horse did not exist between these ancient horses and modern domesticated horses?
It's a great question. And, you know, why were they popular at one point and then they seem to have disappeared and they seem to have come back again? And what the researchers suspect is that the same gene that actually gives these horses their color also causes night blindness, which would have been a disadvantage. So at a certain point, maybe about 10, 15,000 years ago, these horses would have started to disappear because they had this disadvantage. But they may have been more popular before then because their coloring actually may have been an advantage during the Ice Age when there was a lot of snow on the ground. White coloring may have been a good camouflage. And then recently, when humans started to domesticate the horse and maybe this pattern emerged again, they said, oh, that's a really cool pattern. And they started selecting for it again. The horse became popular again. So the fortunes of the polka-dotted horse have really waxed and waned over the thousands of years.
Okay, and what else has been in the news this week?
Well, Carrie, we've been covering a bunch of stories. For Science Now, we've got a story on the world's tiniest electric car. This car is only a few atoms long. Also, a video showing how flies literally switch gears when they fly. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a stranded Russian space probe. Also, a story about a new push by the U.S. government to combat AIDS. And finally, on the topic of infectious diseases, our Science Live this week, and this is our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, is about malaria, a promising new vaccine, and what lies ahead for malaria science. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave. David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the November 11th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.